Welcome back to Faith with Hafe. It's an interesting time all over the world. It's an interesting time in America right now as all of the counting continues. As we're recording this on Friday, there's still no clear winner. Meanwhile, England, where I'm speaking from, has just gone into lockdown again. And these are strange times. So strange. Here we are in the middle of a global pandemic, and we're facing Brexit just around the corner. And it's very easy to get thrown off course and to feel that everything's very, very shaky. To that end, I have asked back. This is a first. You there, John?
I'm here.
This is John Sutherland. He's my guest today. You're my guest, John Sutherland.
I'm honoured beyond words.
You were the first ever Faith with Hafe podcast guest, and you are the first ever to be invited back.
Well, it's just a very lovely thing, and you're a very lovely man.
Well, that's very kind of you to say so. I mean, you're even lovelier, if I may say. And you are, you're to date the most popular of my guests. Everybody loves you. How does that feel?
I don't quite know what to do with that. but it's a lovely thing.
Now, since we spoke back in early May, I had your book, Blue, Keeping the Peace Falling to Pieces. And we talked about your life story from that as a high-flying Met police commander who hit an emotional, mental, physical wall. And I'd like to talk about that today with you, because we talked a lot about your life developing as a policeman and just in general. And then, as you put, keeping the peace and then falling to pieces when it all fell apart. Your life is just so fascinating as a whole, and how you talk about faith within that, integrated within that. But I felt, and you felt, and actually some other people that I've spoken to felt, I want to hear more about the journey since it all fell apart. So the sort of the last bit of the book and beyond. We'll get onto that if we may, because I think it's perfectly timed that we should talk just as here we are, lockdown, November, dark mornings, dark evenings, depression knocking on people's doors. We'll go there, shall we?
Yeah, let's do that.
But before we do, since we last spoke on this podcast, you've released another book, and that book is called Crossing the Line, Lessons from a Life on Duty. And I mean, it's beautifully written and very, I don't want to say this to you, but it's intelligently written, John.
Well, I'm lost for words.
I mean, you talk about so much in this. The chapters are, there's a chapter on knife crime, there's a chapter on alcohol, chapter on domestic abuse, what the things that you see are the biggest challenges to modern society, and then policing's reaction to that. And this book became BBC Radio 4 Book of the Week, didn't it? Was that a surprise to you? And what did that feel like, hearing your words spoken over the airwaves?
It was completely unexpected. A very remarkable thing. Each morning that week, we gathered as a family in the kitchen. It's like the 1950s all over again. The three kids and Bear, my wife, and I gathered around the radio and listened to it being read. And it was a very extraordinary thing. Blue, the first book, was very much my story, a personal story. Crossing the Line is a much broader story about policing and specifically what it reveals about the world that we live in. I've always felt that policing just offers such a singular lens through which to view society. I've often said and written before that the painful privilege of policing is to see all of life and all of death and everything in between. I, and it's unfiltered. You don't get it interpreted by the media. You don't get it constrained into a sort of political soundbite. It's right there in front of your eyes. And so it's always seemed to me that policing offers this completely unique perspective on the world that we all live in. And I had wondered for a long time, I had wondered even as a serving officer, whether I had some sort of duty or responsibility to tell the world outside of policing about the world that policing reveals. I was just very conscious of the fact that an awful lot of what I was seeing and hearing on a daily basis as a consequence of being a copper, an awful lot of what my colleagues and I were dealing with on a daily basis, was stuff that remained unknown to most of the rest of the world.
Yeah.
It wasn't that people didn't care, it was that they didn't know. And so this new book picks up 10 of the biggest challenges we face as a society, and you've listed some of them, and asks three fundamental questions, I suppose. Number one is, what's really going on out there? Number two, what's going wrong out there? Why are so many boys and young men dying on our streets? Why are so many women being murdered in their own homes? Why is extremism on the rise? And having asked those questions, then finally to say, what is it that we can do about it if we want anything to change? Because I flat refuse to believe that we have to keep waking up every day to the repetition of the same old headlines. I do think that it's possible for the world to change. But in order for that to happen, we're going to have to start doing some things very differently.
And your insights and your intelligence, your wisdom, as expressed in that book and in Blue as well, have led to you getting a new nickname, which I love this new nickname for you. It's from Dan Walker, the BBC TV presenter. The morning breakfast show presenter, and he's released a book of the 10 people that have influenced his life, and you're one of them, and he calls you Yoda in a uniform.
It's I think it's probably the favorite nickname, my favorite nickname I've ever been given. I genuinely have no idea how I've ended up in Dan's book, but he's a very lovely man, and he's been very kind. I feel incredibly honoured to be included in a book alongside some very remarkable people.
And I think we should get Dan on this podcast. He can be a guest, and he can come on and explain himself.
Yes, he ought to be asked to explain himself. Chiefly, how on earth I ended up in the book in the first place.
So let's get into it then, John. In the time that we have together, I want to talk with you about depression.
Yeah.
I have no agenda. I've got no questions written down here. I just want to talk to my friend who has been on quite a journey. Let's do this. I was rereading Blue, and there's this quote in here where you say, this is what it feels like. When you first sat up in bed and said to Bear, your wife, I think I'm going to have to go to hospital. I'm scared, really, really scared. As a child, I had a recurring nightmare. In it, I was pursued by a terrifying Yeti-like monster. It hunted me through woodland and hounded me into the grounds of a large unknown country house, and I could never outrun it. My legs would be pumping and my lungs would be burning, and always it would be gaining on me. Eventually, I would do the only thing I could think of, fall to the ground and play dead. And it would stand over me and breathe over me. And that's when I would wake up deeply unsettled by my dreams. Depression is that monster. For hours and days and weeks and months, there will be no waking from it. It will stand over me and breathe over me and drive me into darkness. How long ago was that? That first experience, and how's the darkness now?
So the period of my life that I'm describing there is sort of early 2013, April of 2013, to be precise. And at the time, I was working as the borough commander for Southwark in southeast London. Just a fabulous place to work, surrounded by an extraordinary team of people doing extraordinary things on a daily basis. I loved every single passing minute of it. The problem was that I was starting to be very ill. But the aggravating factor was that I had no idea that that's what was happening to me. I'll very briefly describe sort of the symptoms. So I was in my early 40s, and everything that I'm about to say to you now, if I have any sense of clarity or understanding about it, it's only with the benefit of hindsight. It's only with the benefit of, you know, years to recover and process and try to understand that I've even begun to get my head around it. At the time, I just had no idea. But there were probably three sets of signs, indications that all was not well. The first were those given by my body. As I say, I was 43, so I'd reached that point in a man's life where nothing works quite as well as it once did.
I don't know what you mean.
And I was having recurring trouble with my lower back. I was having recurring trouble with my stomach. But I'd had those on and off over the years, particularly with my back. And really, I didn't give them too much thought. I'm a 43-year-old man and I'm creaking a bit. More than either of those things, though, I was just overwhelmingly exhausted. I mean, absolutely shattered. So the interesting thing was, tiredness was not an unfamiliar thing to me. I'd been a police officer at this point for more than 20 years. And in that time, I'd done a fair amount of shift work. And I'd done a fair few extended tours of duty. And I'd done quite a lot of on-call work. I was a hostage negotiator. It wasn't unusual for the phone to ring in the middle of the night and for me to get out of bed and head off into the middle of nowhere to try and help somebody who was in crisis. So I'd, you know, tiredness was a familiar companion. But in early 2013, there was something more. The tiredness was deeper, more insistent. I don't know whether people listening have ever had the remarkable privilege of going skiing, and if they have, whether they've had the misfortune of falling off the edge of the piste and ending in the really deep stuff. And then trying to walk your way out of it. And walking in ski boots is hard work at the best of times, but when you're waist deep in snow, you know, every stride requires substantially more effort than just walking along the street in your trainers would. And I think, again, with the benefit of hindsight, life had begun to feel a bit like that. Every step was hard work because I was just exhausted. And my body was trying to tell me something. The problem was that I just wasn't listening. And so the second set of signs were with my behavior, which began to change, but changed quite subtly, so much so that I don't think very many people noticed. I didn't notice. And there were only two people actually who noticed and said anything to me about it. One was a very good friend at work, and the other was my wife. But they were subtle changes. The colleague at work noticed that I'd just become a little bit more grumpy. I wasn't shouting or stamping or anything like that. But for me, I mean, I'm a man of 1,000 faults. I'll happily confess to any of them. But in my case, grumpy didn't tend to be one of them. And so for me, grumpy was out of character, and my friend noticed and was a good enough friend that he sat me down to check I was okay. But actually at the time, I was oblivious to the fact that anything might be wrong. And so I was able to say to him, no, yeah, thank you for asking, but I promise you I'm fine. Increasingly though, Bear, my wife, noticed at home too. And if I was to just try to describe what was happening at home, it's that I was becoming increasingly overwhelmed by the small things. I was full up to the brim with the big stuff of life, trying to be a good person, trying to be a good husband, trying to be a good dad, absolutely trying to be a good borough commander for Southwark. And I was so full of those things that I had no room left for the small things. It could be something as simple as one of the children needing help with their homework, or something as daft as a light bulb that needed changing. But I had nothing left to give. Like my body, my behavior was trying to tell me something, but I wasn't paying any attention. And so thirdly, my brain took over, having failed to pay attention to my body and having ignored my behavior. My brain began to take over, and I started a descent into crippling anxiety, and then ultimately into depression. And I'm happy to talk about both of those things if you want to hear.
Did you have panic attacks?
I did. Yeah, having never had them before in my life. The anxiety, like the tiredness, was not in and of itself an unfamiliar thing to me. There have been plenty of occasions in my life where I'd felt anxious in circumstances where anxiety would be a perfectly reasonable thing to feel. I'd felt anxious before my exams at school. I'd felt anxious before my interview to join the Met, only job I ever applied for, only job I ever wanted to do. There was no plan B. I felt anxious when I asked Bear to marry me. I felt anxious when our children were born. There are lots of occasions where I felt anxious, but fast forward to April of 2013, and what I'd begun to experience was infinitely beyond anything I'd ever encountered before. And it began to stalk me in the day and haunt me in the night. And I started waking suddenly with the night terrors, you know, almost that kind of stereotypical image from a TV program or a film. I would suddenly sit bolt upright in bed, wide-eyed, white-knuckled, teeth clenched with terror, but with no obvious reason to explain it. I mean, what did I have to be anxious about? I'm one of those incredibly fortunate people who's married to his best mate, and our children, we've got three girls who are growing up beautifully. They're healthy and happy. And aside from the mortgage, we didn't have a penny of debt. And I didn't have any kind of deep hidden secrets in my past or in my internet browsing history that were going to jump out and sort of derail life. And then there was work. Well, I loved it. I loved every single passing minute of it. And so what did I have to be anxious about? It seemed to be nothing, and yet it was everything in the darkness of the night. And it was so bad that I'd have to wake Bear up just so that she could hold on to me and tell me that everything was going to be okay. And the extraordinary thing was that I didn't recognize or realize or understand that I was ill.
For how long?
Well, this went on for a few weeks, actually. And I was fighting it every step of the way. I just thought that this was one of those things in life that I had to overcome by sheer force of will or effort. I approached it a little bit like, you see the front row of a rugby scrum. I don't have the physique to play rugby, but I love watching.
That's been an experience I've always managed to avoid.
That moment before the scrum begins where they crouch and they pause, yeah, and you can see every muscle and sinew is tensed as they're ready to drive forward. And that's how I think I approached this, that it was just something I had to overcome. I didn't understand that I was ill. I absolutely didn't realize that I needed help, and increasingly urgently needed help. Each morning, I swung my feet out of bed and I planted my feet on the carpet and I took a deep breath and I told myself to go again. And each morning, that's what I tried to do. And for a period of time, a relatively short period of time, I was able to do that, and work seemed to provide some respite or at least some distraction.
And of course, we live in a culture that is Well, Britain's known for keep calm and carry on.
Yeah.
As boys, we grow up with this idea that you don't cry, you don't ask for help, you just crack on.
Yeah.
So that ends up sort of adding to the whole thing, doesn't it? Rather than just simply saying, I need some help, I'm going to talk to someone.
There's definitely an element of that. In my case, I mean, I've never been afraid or ashamed to shed a tear in the past or to talk about feelings. But I was a roughy-tufty copper, and I was trying to be a capable and competent dad, a caring husband. I didn't have time to be ill. There was too much going on, too many responsibilities that I had, too many duties to fulfill. But more than anything was just the simple basic fact that I didn't understand what was happening to me. And that seems an extraordinary thing to say, because I grew up in a home where my dad had bipolar disorder. And so mental illness was not an unfamiliar thing to me. And of course, as a police officer, you deal with it in one form or another almost every single day, certainly with extraordinary frequency. You're dealing with people out on the street who are in mental health crisis, or you're dealing with people who are missing from secure psychiatric wards, or you're dealing with people at the worst points and on the worst days of their lives. And so both personally and professionally, mental illness was something that I had a reasonably good working knowledge of. And yet I had this extraordinary blind spot when it came to me. I just didn't understand that I was ill until it was too late.
I was driving through, I was crossing Oxford Street, had the kids in the car about 3 weeks ago, and it was just getting to darkness, and the lights were coming on. And we're sitting at a red light, and this completely naked man was walking down Oxford Street. And the thing, he was absolutely stark naked. And we were sitting there, did not know what to say. And he looked like it was the most normal thing in the world to him. But then a passing police van, sort of the blue lights went on and they pulled over. And the thing that struck me was how they just got out, like you're saying, they just got out like it was the most normal thing in the world. They didn't race out and grab him. They just started chatting to him. And I was so impressed with that. But exactly, that's exactly what you're saying, is that you see this every day. Maybe not quite that, but that's what...
Well, as a serving officer, I've had exactly that experience. And wrapping a naked man up in a bit of police uniform to afford him some dignity. I mean, there's a lot of, the word pandemic has entered into the common vernacular this year as a consequence of coronavirus. But coronavirus is not the only pandemic. There are those that I talk about in a crime context, domestic violence being the most significant one, perhaps. But actually mental health, or mental ill health itself, is one of the other pandemics that's raging at the moment, and it's one of the hidden pandemics. And the incidence of mental ill health, we know, has gone up very significantly as a consequence of coronavirus and lockdown and all of the uncertainty that now exists in the world.
Yeah.
And it's a subject that we must be talking about. And it's a subject that is deserving of enormous compassion and understanding. Because that poor man you saw on Oxford Street was ill. And actually, I'm so glad that there were police officers there to offer him a helping hand. But actually, what he really needs a helping hand from is doctors and nurses. Where he really needs to be is in a hospital, not in the back of a police van. And it's often been said in the past that one of the measures of a society is the regard that it has for its most vulnerable members. And people suffering with serious mental ill health are amongst the most vulnerable in society. And I fear that we're failing an awful lot of them.
So this is 2013. We're now 7 years on. How are you doing now?
You're kind to ask. I'm a man on a journey. I mean, I'm way better now than I was 7.5 years ago. And maybe I'll say a little bit more in a minute about kind of the worst of the illness, because it's important to talk about that. But I'm much better now than I was then. In some ways, deep down inside me, I'm probably better than I've ever been in my life. But I did myself some permanent damage along the way. It's why I was medically retired from policing a couple of years ago. It's why I'm no longer able to do many of the things that I used to do. So both out of necessity and choice, I live life much more quietly and gently these days. I speak a bit, I write a bit, and I rest a lot in between times.
Can we talk about the healing process, where that began for you? I'm presuming you went on to meds and had counselling, psychotherapy to some degree?
Yeah, so, you know, I don't know how many people listening will have experienced depression for themselves, or whether anyone close to them might have done. But my experience of it is to say, and this is the best I've ever been able to describe it, it's to say that depression is not the same as sadness. In fact, sadness is to depression as a puddle is to the Pacific. They're both wet, but that's where the comparison ends. And depression, in terms of its scale and its depth and its overwhelming intensity, was by far the most horrifying and terrifying thing I've ever encountered. And it took me to the very edge of life. And for a long time, I was very seriously ill. But the mending process, well, number one, it begins with the recognition that you're ill. And number two, then putting up your hand and asking for help, or accepting the need for help. You know, it's often been said in the past, or suggested in the past, that putting up your hand and asking for help is a sign of weakness. Actually, the reality is it's a sign of extraordinary strength. It takes incredible courage to say, hang on here, I'm sick, I'm not coping, and I need someone to help me. And there were three very practical things that helped me to get better slowly over time, and helped me to stay well. Number one is learning how to rest in a world that is moving far too fast. You know, we live in a world where we can click a finger and a cab will arrive at the pavement where we're standing. Or we can click another finger and wait a few minutes longer and a meal will arrive at our front doors. You know, we want faster food and we want faster transport connections and we want faster broadband, and faster and faster and faster we go. And it's not good for any of us. It's doing us all extraordinary harm. And technology is a big part of that. And so finding ways to slow down and rest and switch off, quite literally as well as metaphorically, is so important. And rest doesn't necessarily mean the absence of physical activity. We know that there's a huge amount of research now, and common sense tells us that exercise is good for your mental health.
Yeah.
Sometimes the very thing you need to do is go for a run or a swim or a bike ride, or in my case, I go much more gently and walk the family dog.
The difficulty is it can be the last thing you want to do.
Absolutely, absolutely. But it's a bit like, you know, even when you're in the best of health, the idea of going for a run, particularly if it's cold or dark or wet, it always feels incredibly uninviting, but without fail you're always glad that you've done it after the fact. And so, just, you know, for me in those early days, sometimes just getting up and getting out of the house was so important, even if I was only able to shuffle to the end of the street and by the newspaper so that I could do the crossword. I mean, it really was as simple and as basic as that. So sometimes exercise is exactly the thing you need, but equally sometimes rest needs to mean rest, actually finding ways just to stop and breathe and switch the phone off and just allow ourselves to recover. So learning how to rest was the first thing. The second thing was learning how to talk. I got referred for emergency counselling when I first fell ill. And you get six sessions on the NHS, for which I'm incredibly grateful, but six sessions is never enough. And we were remarkably fortunate that I struck up a really good relationship with my therapist and that she had the capacity to continue to see me privately after my six sessions came to an end. And we were incredibly fortunate that work continued to pay me. And so we were able to afford to pay for those counselling sessions. And I kept on seeing Anna for over 5 years after my breakdown. And I'd go back and see her now in a heartbeat if I needed to. Now, not everybody needs that level of professional assistance over that length of time, but absolutely it's one of the oldest truths of them all, that it's good to talk. That's always been true and it always will be true. It's good to talk. So I had to learn how to rest, I had to learn how to talk. And then the third thing was I had to learn how to follow sound medical advice. And you mentioned meds. And the first thing I did when I woke up this morning was to take some antidepressant medication. And I've done that every morning for the last 7.5 years. And I'll do it every morning for the rest of my life if I need to. And I will do it without hesitation and I will do it without shame. The interesting thing is, you see, the first time or the first two or three times probably that I said that out loud in public, I take antidepressants and I'm not ashamed. Actually, the person I was most trying to convince was me.
Yeah.
Because there is still this extraordinary stigma that exists in society that is specific to mental ill health and that is specific to antidepressant medication. And if anything, I think it's magnified and intensified in a church setting where people are told on occasions, and I know because this has happened to friends, that they're told that their mental ill health is evidence of their lack of faith, that their apparent need to take antidepressant medication is indicative of the fact that they've not prayed enough or believed enough. And we just need to call that out right here and now. Say that is deeply ignorant, deeply irresponsible, deeply dangerous thing to say.
It's so odd, isn't it? Because the brain is just another part of the body. If you've got exactly. Backache, you take ibuprofen. You know, if you have some disease, we were talking last week to Patrick Pearson Miles, who requires permanent dialysis. So you do it. Why do we?
I often use the example of I've got two younger sisters, both amazing. And Annie, the middle one, has had cancer twice in her life, once as a child, once more recently as an adult, and has survived on both occasions and is an extraordinary human being. And most recently, she had thyroid cancer, as a consequence of which she had her thyroid removed, as a consequence of which her body now no longer naturally produces something called thyroxine. Now, this is where my expertise thins out a little bit. I'm not good on what thyroxine is or does, but I know it's important.
This is where we're starting to really push the boundaries of Yoda in uniform, isn't it?
Yes, exactly. I'm way out of my comfort zone here. But bodies need thyroxine. And now that would be a real problem for my sister, were it not for the wonders of modern medicine.
Yeah.
You can take medication each day that makes up for what's missing in her body and allows her to live an otherwise normal life. And none of us bats an eyelid at that. It's the most normal thing in the world. In fact, we'd think she was an idiot if she didn't take it.
Yes.
Oh, so why should it be any different with my head? It would appear that there's something missing up there. My wife and you and others will, I dare say, tell listeners that it's more than one thing that's missing. And that would be an enormous problem for me were it not for the wonders of modern medication. I can take something each day that makes up for what's missing, at least in part, and allows me to live an otherwise fairly normal life. So why would I hesitate? And why would I be ashamed? It's incredibly important just to say at this juncture that antidepressant medication doesn't work for everybody, or it doesn't work for everybody in quite the same way or to quite the same degree.
And there are different types, and you might actually find it.
And that's in part a product of the fact that, you know, we don't understand brains nearly as well as we understand thyroids.
Okay.
Or indeed pretty much every other aspect of our physical health. You know, mental ill health is still a huge kind of undiscovered country. But the truth about antidepressant meds is that they do work for an awful lot of people. And they work for me, and they are a critical part of my having recovered and staying well. And no one should ever be ashamed to take them.
You have a very, I can't believe I'm about to say this, you're a very balanced person. I'm kicking myself for having to,
that's the second time in this podcast that you've apologized for paying me a compliment.
But you are, you have this beautiful holistic view of life that I know that you would say that a lot of that has come from your experience of the last few years. And I know that you would say that, in fact, I know that you said this on the last podcast, that you wouldn't wish what you've experienced on your worst enemy, not that you have enemies, but also you wouldn't exchange it for the world. And I know that in some way, your experience of faith and God, and you mentioned some of the difficult reactions of church to mental illness, but generally speaking, your faith, I don't know how your faith is not being kicked to touch. You're preaching on Sunday online from your church. You still believe it?
My faith's an awful lot simpler now than it once was. I'm a preacher's kid. I was born into an Anglican vicarage. I grew up knowing that Jesus was the answer to the Sunday school question. And I've got to a point now, significantly as a consequence of my personal experience, where I would say, and I write this in the book, I'd say I'm less certain of more things than I've ever been in my life. The religion that I grew up with and that I relied on failed me utterly when I got ill. The thing that saved me was grace.
What was that in the background then?
Sorry, that was my letterbox going. It was the post arriving. Just at an inopportune moment.
Just as we were just dwelling in that moment of grace.
Maybe I thought the connection had gone down, actually.
tell me about grace.
So, you know, like I said, I grew up in a vicarage. I grew up reading the Bible and saying my prayers like a good boy. And yet somehow, as a fully grown, mature adult, husband, dad, police officer, I was still laboring under the belief that somehow I had to earn God's approval and affection, that somehow it was up to me to earn my way, that it was all about me. And somehow I'd entirely missed this extraordinary, magical, mystical, beautiful thing called grace. The most significant moment for me. So for weeks and months on end, when I was at my worst, I didn't go to church for 6 months. I couldn't read my Bible. I could barely say a word of prayer. But I remember lying in silence, desperately unwell, kind of crying out to God, if indeed he was there. And said to him, if you're there, I've got nothing. I've got nothing to offer you. At that particular moment in time, I felt as though I had failed at everything. I'd failed at being a police officer. I'd failed at being a husband and a dad. I'd failed at being a man. I'd failed. I emphasize that's how I felt then. It's not how I see it now. But that's where I was at. And I said to God, I have got nothing. I've got nothing to offer you. I've got nothing to bring you. And the question I asked him was, is my nothing enough? Enough for you to love me? And the extraordinary answer to that question, the utterly revolutionary answer to that question was yes. Your nothing is enough. And that's when I began, for the first time after 43 and a bit years of life, to discover something of the mystery of grace, this rumor that I am loved beyond measure, just as I am.
Before we started recordings, we were talking about the Japanese. This is going to make us sound so cultured and highbrow, but you and I were discussing the Japanese art form of kintsugi, where the broken pot, or I was going to say piece of china, but it's Japanese. If something gets broken, then they don't just put it together with invisible glue. They mix the glue with gold dust. And then what is created is these veins of gold connecting the broken pieces. And it's considered to be even more beautiful. It's an extraordinary picture of really what you're talking about.
I wouldn't go so far as to describe myself as beautiful.
No, wasn't what I was saying.
But you're right. It is the most exquisite metaphor for what grace, the grace of God, can do with pain and with brokenness. You know, my mental ill health is a part of my story. It's a part of who I am. It's why I wouldn't give up the last 7.5 years, because I've learned so much. I love that idea of beauty and brokenness.
So here we are. We've just started another lockdown. The winter looks pretty long right now. There's no vaccine probably for months. Rest, talk, follow sound medical advice. What else would you say to someone that is listening to this that's just really struggling today?
And I often emphasize to people that I'm no expert in any of these things. I'm just a man with some stories to tell. But if ever I get asked that question, and sometimes people will drop me a message privately to let me know they're struggling. And I make them two simple promises, absolute cast iron guaranteed promises. Promise number one is that you're not on your own. And that's one of the things about mental ill health, is because it's all happening internally, it's incredibly isolating. It threatens to cut you off from the rest of the world. And I know for sure that when I was at my worst, it seemed impossible to me that anyone else could understand what I was going through, that I must be the only person on the planet going through this. And the truth is that I wasn't on my own then, and others aren't on their own now. Actually, there are hundreds of thousands of us, many more than we might realize. So promise number one is that you're not on your own. And promise number two is you will get better. This too shall pass. And I remember sitting down with my GP the first week that I was off sick. And I had, you know, back then, no clue what was happening to me. I just knew that I was in an incredibly bad way. And he was just wonderful. And he threw his appointment schedule out of the window and just spent as long with me as I needed and explained to me what he thought was happening to me and what he was going to do about it and what together we were going to do about it. And at some point in that conversation, he said to me, "I promise you, you'll get better." And I 100% didn't believe him. Because that seemed impossible to me. I felt so ill. The depths of the despair were so great that it seemed impossible to me that I would ever find my way back again. But he was right. He was right. And sometimes I think it's not only all right, but it's necessary to let or to allow other people to do our hoping and our believing for us. So I'd make those two promises. You're not on your own and you will get better. And I guess the only other thing I'd say, often now when I'm texting friends or signing off an email or particularly to someone who's having a tough time, I just say to them, go gently. In this world that appears to be unraveling, in every possible way, the exhortation is to go gently. You know, back in those very dark days when I was having that conversation with the God I wasn't convinced was there, there was just one verse from the Psalms that somehow found its way into the back of my head and stayed there. And it was the verse that says, "Be still and know that I am God." That seems like an idea to live by.
I just want to keep talking all day. We've come to the end of our time together, John. Thank you for being with me today.
Thank you for having me. It's always a privilege.
And I want to publicly say thank you to you, because honestly, I've had a really hard time recently, and you have been there for me, and I love you.
Well, I love you too.
I want to finish with this. I just found this bookmark. It's actually in your book. I pulled it out, and it's from the Iona community, and it's this wonderful prayer of blessing, which I want to speak over you, John, over your family, over mine, over everyone listening to this. Deep peace of the running river to you. Deep peace of the flowing air to you. Deep peace of the quiet earth to you. Deep peace of the shining stars to you. Deep peace of the Sun of Peace to you. You've been listening to Faith with Haith. Go gently. Much love.